Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Islam Through Objects represents the state of the field of Islamic material cultural studies, with contributions from scholars of religion, anthropologists, art historians, folklorists, and other disciplines. Anna Bigelow brings together a wide range of perspectives on Islamic materiality to debunk myths of Islamic aversion to material aspects of religion. Each chapter focuses on a single object in daily use by Muslims, including prayer books, coins, amulets, clothing, jewelry, and bodily and domestic adornments, to consider both generic and particular aspects of the object in question, framed by an introduction that assesses the various approaches to Islamic material culture and recent scholarship. Islam Through Objects provides a template for the study of religion and material culture, which engages current theory, subtle and nuanced narratives, and the creative and imaginal capacity of Muslims through history. In our conversation, we discuss key subjects in material religion scholarship: theological foundations for Islamic notions of materiality, the uses of visual images as historical vantage points, the role of objects as a means for marking and making identity, the life of material items in ritual and social action, and the future study of Islam through objects. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies. Here's my conversation with Anna Bigelow about Islam Through Objects, published with Bloomsbury in 2021. Welcome, Anna. Thanks for joining me on New Books in Islamic Studies. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's really great to be here. Thank you. I'm a fan of the show.
Well, we're a fan of yours, and especially with this new book, Islam Through Objects. It's a really, really cool project that I've personally been excited about, hearing about this work on material Islamic studies that you've been doing for a long time. So I'm excited to get into it. Before we get to the book, though, if you could, what's kind of your journey as an academic? What are some of your background and training, perhaps mentors or moments that have been influential in bringing you to how you study Islam, the areas you're interested in? What's your trajectory?
Well, there's sort of a lot of ways into how I ended up studying this and studying, particularly getting increasingly drawn into the study of Islamic objects or Islamic things, and how that can be a really useful way to explore particular Islamic worlds in ways that are much more textured and exciting. And I think I could look back to when I first became really interested in religion, that I've always been fascinated by ritual. I've always been interested in religious processes that involve a lot of movements of bodies and space and objects and smells and tastes and resonances and sounds. And I think that sensibility of always being very interested in the broader world in which doctrines and practices and theologies and conceptions are being actually lived out has really always drawn me. So when I look back on my training, and I first started doing religious studies in college, and I was also an English major. I used to read novels once upon a time, but now I feel like I don't do that nearly enough. And then I went to India for a period of time in between my undergraduate and master's degree. And during that experience, I became particularly interested in the phenomenon of Muslims and non-Muslims interacting together at the same sacred spaces. And so that's really been one of the sort of animating frames for a lot of my research ever since, is looking at places where Muslims and non-Muslims are, you know, doing things with each other, around each other, near each other, and are often motivated by many of the same hopes, dreams, needs, and feelings that are incredibly human. And so that's always felt to me like for a long time it felt very understudied. I think it's starting to actually gain a lot of traction, and people are bringing lots of new and interesting approaches to this that I'm hoping will be creating a really robust new field of study. And that's another project that I'm working on in other ways. But throughout this, then when I started my PhD at UC Santa Barbara, one of my mentors who works in India, David Gordon White, asked me this question when we were doing a translation of something together. And I don't even remember exactly what it was, sort of a popular chapbook kind of thing. And one of the points that was raised in the chapbook was about tying a thread in a particular way. And I, you know, was really just translating it and wasn't analyzing it much in our discussion. And he said, I hope that you'll pay more attention in the future as much to the thread itself as to what it said that the thread does. So it was a question that kind of puzzled me at the time, because I was like, what does that mean to think about the thread itself and try to evaluate or assess a thread as a material object, as opposed to as a ritual instruction that is simply what you do when you do it, and because that's the right way to do it. And so that's always kind of sat in my mind. And throughout my research, which is mostly based at Sufi shrines in India and sometimes in Turkey, at shrines, particularly those devoted to Mary, that are visited by Muslims and Christians, I've been struck by the proliferation of things that move through those spaces. And so this has become part of that sort of intellectual curiosity that goes back before college, but I think is starting to take on some increasingly focus with this project and with a few other projects. So, as you know, Christian, some years ago through the AAR, we had a session on material Islam, and that where I presented, and where another colleague of ours, Kombis Ghanaya Basri at Reed College, and I sort of came out of that thinking we wanted to start a focused seminar within the AAR Islamic Studies groups on material Islam, so we could see what is essentially the state of the field. Religious studies, as I'm sure many of the listeners know, is a very eclectic discipline, with people doing philological text-based studies and people doing anthropological studies and people doing archaeological or art historical, and so many different approaches that people take. And so we were hoping that through this series of, we had 5 years of gatherings with a whole host of fascinating scholars at all levels of their career, talking about what is material Islam. And so that became a great way to learn more from different people in different fields and to bring people into conversation with each other. And from that project, this edited volume came into focus. And then also Kombis and I are co-editing currently a forthcoming issue of the Yale Journal, The Material and Visual Cultures of Religion, that will be focused also on material Islam. And that will have, you know, scads of images and different formats of essays as well. So that's also something to look forward to coming out on this focus.
Cool. That's great. I mean, while it sounds simple, like, okay, material religion, it's about things. Lots of listeners might not really know what that kind of looks like in terms of an analytical lens. So can you talk a little bit about what some of the like key working assumptions and approaches of material religion scholarship are for those people who aren't familiar with that kind of subfield?
Yeah, sure. So in a certain sense, it's difficult to absolutely say that this is the approach to material religion that the field takes. But in all cases, what scholars are looking at is what particular bodies or objects, animate and inanimate, how they populate the religious worlds in which they're located. Different theorists have different ideas about how that works. So for some, objects only have meaning to the extent that a human actor engages that object and gives it meaning. And that might be through a particular way of manipulating the object by, using a rosary to engage in prayer. It's only meaningful because the human is manipulating it. It doesn't have any active agency of its own or any active qualities or feelings that it elicits in others of its own. So in approaches that take sort of a human-centered vision of what an object is, then essentially it leaves the object as a thing to be deciphered for what it signifies within that particular religious community. So it symbolizes something. It represents, so as one could quite classically say, the cross represents the crucifixion of Jesus and the sacrifice, and it has, of course, different theological resonances in different Christian denominations, but essentially it would be recognizable to most Christians as a sign standing in for Jesus. From what is sort of emerging, not entirely as the new materialist studies has a number of different manifestations, but sort of generally thinking about new materialism as a way of imagining that objects and things are also doing things in the world in and of themselves and elicit particular responses from the world that it interacts with, such that one has to move around objects in certain ways and not others, that you might have, humans may have emotional responses which are not just coming imputed to the object, but are actually brought to, understood by the individual to be brought to the person by that object itself. Or objects could be seen to have power, that they are transformative, and having them in certain spaces demands particular ritual attention or responses or ways of interacting with them that are understood to be correct, or even that certain emotional responses are understood to be appropriate or diagnostic of one's conditions, but that the whatever is authorizing that power is actually something intrinsic to the object rather than being imputed to the object by the individual. So we see a lot of more recent scholarship sort of looking at these as intertwined in a way, that there are the objects both have their own being in the world that shapes the world around them, and that is not solely dependent on human meaning making, but then at the same time, human meaning making is always happening around objects as well. So I think we can think of these as many of the essays in this volume are kind of exploring a little bit of both directions that we can see operating nowadays. So material religion really began with the study of Christian images and objects. Scholars like Colleen McDaniel and David Morgan really sort of brought history and art history together with religious studies in a way to take seriously things that were often thought of as peripheral or ephemeral or not as perhaps revealing or substantive as texts and doctrines and et cetera, and ritual analysis. And so actually to think of the thing itself as being just as important in understanding how a religion or a particular religious world is shaped and defined, how people make their spaces significant to them within religions, and how objects in the world inform the way a religion exists in the world. So I don't know, it's probably a little vague, but we can talk about some specific examples in greater detail. But I think one of the big projects that I see this volume in particular is doing is calling attention to things that might end to particular Islamic cultures that are often not given much attention because, as you know well, there tends to be a very textualist and very classicist bias within Islamic studies. And within art history, there's tended to be a sort of formalist and descriptive bias that it tends towards originalism, the idea that something that was originally made or created to be some a particular thing, that it is so now essential to it that any changes are corruptive or corrosive to their identity. But then when you see an object in, or a place or a thing that changes identity over time, the religious worlds in which that thing exists do not regard them as inauthentic or lesser than. They remain very important ways of conceptualizing what that religion is for that community.
Yeah, I was going to ask about this relationship between kind of the material religion subfield and Islamic studies, which really hasn't been taken up in very specific ways. Maybe people could say art historians, but as you just kind of mentioned, it's kind of a certain set of objects that are identified as worthy of study in that field. Can you talk a little bit about how Islamic studies is kind of set up in relation to material religion in terms of what gets left out of a kind of art historian approach, and perhaps why do you think it's taken so long for folks in Islamic studies to kind of go on this? I mean, material religion has been a very specific subfield for at least two decades now. So, and I mean, you're not, of course, the first person to look at this, but this is one of the first books that really kind of nails it as a key way of doing stuff. So why do you think it's taken so long?
Well, I'm this 100%, neither I nor the authors included in this book, although actually some of them have been there at the beginning, but of how this intersects with Islamic studies and the study of material religion. But I think you're very right to point out that there are some expected tensions there, and perhaps some of those have led to more division within the fields of Islamic studies broadly around questions of materiality than actually it should or could exist, and that certainly we can see is existing now. There are, of course, assumptions in Islamic studies around Islamic iconophobia or iconoclasm, that Islam has an abhorrence of the image and particularly figural images, and that therefore there is simply a turn towards the text. And so even when one discusses things like calligraphy as being the highest form of art in Islam, that this is merely because it is so often an expression of the divine word in the form of Quranic inscriptions or praise of the prophet, that one sees, either monumentally as epigraphic elements of mosques or other structures or things that are might be quite minute and used by the individual. So like jewelry that is engraved with passages from the Quran, et cetera. And so there's sort of been a focus on the discursive, if you will, and as one of the primary lenses, the primary modes through which Islam expresses itself in the world, and the way Muslims interact with it is through concepts, through text, through doctrines, through theologies. And I think one of the, and then for art historians and architectural historians who work in Islamic studies, there's a huge catch-up being played because there's such a vast repertoire and such a vast set of materials that have really not yet been fully analyzed, brought into the conversations. And so I think these fields worked more in parallel to one another for longer than might ideally have been the case. But in the last, 15 years, I would say 10 years at least, there has been a growing body of literature that is taking seriously all of these questions. And so we can think of Jamal Elias's fantastic book, Aisha's Cushion, which came out in the 2012, I believe, And that really takes on the notions of how did this idea around images and objects being forbidden within Islam come into play, and what are all the ways in which Muslims have always argued and grappled and had varying views on this. The work of the art historian Christian Gruber has, of course, also been really instrumental in helping to bring more contextualized studies of Islamic art into the conversation. So she goes far beyond merely the formal properties. Finbar Barry Flood also has done great work in this regard, but by really embedding Islamic things into their histories, Niall Green and many others. So this is, I think, a move that is starting to coalesce in various ways and is really helping, I think, Islamic studies scholars across disciplines to be in conversation in really productive ways, which was also a hope of this this book edited volume project, was to bring together people who worked as, who were trained as art historians or anthropologists or religious studies scholars or historians, what have you, and to have people all together thinking about similar problems that we wonder over, but through very different skill sets that we've developed over the years. And so I think that this is one of the things that's really exciting about it, and one of the reasons why religious studies, I think, lends itself well to this, because that's kind of already our habit, is to draw in the theories and methods and ideas from a multiplicity of disciplines.
Yeah. One other thing that you do in kind of setting up the book that I wasn't really expecting was you provide perhaps what we might think of as kind of the Islamic foundation for the study of material religion, in the sense of kind of talking about the internal theological justification for a material approach. So can you tell us a little bit about that? What do Islamic primary sources like the Quran or Hadith or later theological discourses tell us about Islamic materiality?
Yeah, thank you. It is such an interesting question. And of course, there are also multiple ways to look at this. And what I lay out is just one way to say that we're not just bringing, you know, 21st century theory from a Western academic approach to things that have emerged from Islamic worlds and applying theory without, you know, from nowhere, that has no resonance. In fact, from the get-go, we can see in Quranic sources, in early theological discourses, ways in which Muslims have always been thinking about what are things, what is the material manifest world all about? How do we arrange ourselves in relation to it? What do these things mean in relation to the relationship between humans and God, or between the created world more broadly than just humans and God? So from that perspective, I thought it was helpful, particularly as my hope is that this volume will be useful for classroom teaching, lay out a few of those conceptual frames that can help people realize that this is not just a bunch of, you know, academics now, you know, sitting in rooms in their offices on university campuses, pondering a set of prayer beads that they picked up from in wherever their research sites might be. But this is actually something that has always been a question in the forefront of many thinkers' minds. So I opened the introduction here with a discussion evoking Ibn Arabi and his ideas about the nature of objects as existing in a state, the natural state of fitra, of consciousness of the createdness by God, that this is something that is true not just of humans and is one of the fundamental projects of the human Muslim, to remain aware in an active way of that state of being, and to try to work against all the forces of life that draw us away from that consciousness, but actually to see that everything in some way is existent in the way that it is recognizing that createdness. But the problem for humans in particular is that we don't always understand the languages of the things. And so Ibn Arabi quotes from the Quran saying, there is nothing that does not glorify him in praise, but you do not understand their glorification. Surely he is clement and concealing. And that's from the 17th surah, chapter 44th verse. And so this idea that everything, all things are in the state of glorification and praise, but it is not always easy to know what that glorification, you can't understand it, signifies that there are multiple levels of existence and being, and that it is a project to tune oneself into that. And tuning oneself correctly into that, those frequencies, into those registers, is part of the test of life in this world. To orient oneself properly in relation to things that are attractive is a project, to appreciate as a sign of God rather than as a necessarily a source simply of worldly pleasure or aesthetic, merely aesthetic pleasure. Everything that is beautiful has this other level to it from that perspective. And so, while not trying to shift material Islamic studies into thinking that all materiality is simply a manifestation of an underlying theology, I think it's still important to recognize the ways in which varying Islamic concepts that and ways of thinking about the material world are should be part of the conversation of theorizing what an object is. So when Ibn Arabi suggests that every object, an inanimate and animate thing, has a haq, has a kind of right that is due to it, that concept is actually very similar to ideas that we see coming from new materialists today, who suggest ideas around object agency. And similar and yet different. You know, there's some distinctions in the mode of argumentation. There's distinctions in what's seen as legitimate evidentiary material, etc. But we can still think about this as forms of theorizing the world that sort of collectivizes this project of that we are part of in academia, in particular, of trying to figure out. But everybody is a part of, whether academics or not, of trying to figure out how the world works and how they want to be within it. And so I think that kind of decenters theory a little bit from the ivory tower and helps us to recognize a multitude of ways in which we are always humans and non-human things are, in a sense, are offering theories of what it means to be in this particular world. And in the Islamic world, of course, that will always be oriented in some fashion towards conceptions of the divine.
Yeah, I thought it was really helpful in the broader conversation that that the book is discussing, especially since material approach to Islamic studies is new. It felt very useful. The book, the way you structure the book, you have four parts. Titled Tracing Images, Identifying Objects, Objects and Practice, Circulatory Systems. And each of these tackle materiality in different ways. And in the first, the Tracing Images, the authors use a visual image as a starting point. So can you talk a little bit about how exploring the production and circulation of images reveals new or deeper Muslim histories?
Yeah, no, I mean, first, I just have to say how fortunate I was to have such an amazing group of people who agreed to be a part of this project. It was really just such a pleasure to learn with and from them. So I wanted to start the book with an essay by Kayla Renee Wheeler that is putting front and center a photo from the 1960s by Gordon Parks, who was a fantastic 20th century African-American photographer who did a lot of work for Life magazine, among other things. And so in 1963, he took a picture of Ethel Sharif, one of the members of the Nation of Islam. And it's, you know, just a simply fantastic image of a woman absolutely owning herself, staring straight into the camera, and wearing the uniform that she had been a part of the making and interpretation of within the Nation of Islam. So normally, a lot of studies of the Nation of Islam focus on the nation and situate it as being divergent from other forms of Islam that are more commonly practiced in other parts of the world or in the United States itself. And so the nation becomes somewhat marginalized or viewed even by some Muslims as being non-Islamic or excessively variant. This essay doesn't need to go into that kind of debate, but simply takes very seriously the ways in which Sharif and other women in the Nation of Islam formed themselves and disciplined themselves through their practices of dress, and how this image, which had drew Wheeler into this particular study in so many ways, really reflects just the centrality of human dignity, the importance of agency that women were able to take in terms of not only making and wearing this, but modifying and making it in their own distinctive ways over generations. It also shifts us away from understanding a particular religious movement again through texts and doctrines, but seeing it as profoundly shaped and informed by material practices and the ways in which people orient themselves towards objects. So Wheeler's essay, I think, sets the right tone for the beginning of the book by just moving everything to a we're not starting in 7th century Arabia when we start to study Islam. It doesn't always have to be a story ab origino to the present to make sense of anything. In fact, we might get much more engaging stories and understand things on their own terms if we can't resist that sometimes. So I really appreciated that about that essay. And then we move into Christiane Gruber's fantastic sort of detective story with a kind of forensic analysis of an image she found of a young Muhammad in Iran and how that image circulated and resonated with different images that appeared in French and other sources that moved between media from paper drawings to carpets and etchings and engravings and a whole host of other sources. And so from this, we see the circulations of ideas and conceptions of greatness and the ways in which ideas may originate in one place and circulate to another and then be reconsumed within the place that the first image came from in all sorts of fascinating ways. And so here the image, in a sense, it isn't a single image at all, but rather an image that adjusts and modifies and creates a kind of a conversation between these different milieu in which it is oriented. And then finally, the last essay in that section from Richard McGregor talks about the tracings of the prophet's sandal and how that they work both as objects that carry baraka or the blessing power to heal, for example, or to provide a sort of a focal point for worship and devotion. And he works through ideas from Deleuze to Ibn Arabi again and Ibn Asakir to think about what is repetition and how. So, surprisingly, we think of copies as being often less authentic or less original. But this essay, I think, really helps us to challenge that and consider what is the power of repetition and replication.
The second part is, you call it identifying objects, but this section really what is up to is thinking about how objects are used as a means for marking or making identities. Can you talk a little bit about how the objects in this section mark communal belonging in Muslim context? What kinds of meanings do these objects take on for their users?
Yeah, so the three objects here are lapel pins worn in the Nation of Islam and the Five Percenter Nations of Gods and Earths, prayer beads, particularly prayer beads in the Tijani West African Sufi community, and a cap worn particularly in this case by Chishti Sufis in South Asia. And so in each case, It's again, each of these objects mark belonging in a particular group or in a particular subgroup. And the question of who gets to wear or use them, how that comes about, the question of where this is located within individual practice and identity formation and self-discipline and making oneself an appropriate wearer or user of the particular object. Each essay by Michael Knight, Usman Kobo, and Scott Kugel, respectively, each of these objects create a sense of being a member of a particular group. And they not only, you know, is a way of marking that and displaying that to those who would know how to read them legibly. So not everybody who walks down a street in, say, Hyderabad would know that the particular style of cap that a person is wearing is related to the Chishti Sufis, and some might know, some might not. So not everybody knows that a particular lapel pin signifies that you're a 5%er, or that the number of beads in and the way they're marked out in your tasbih or your rosary is means you're a particular subgroup of the Tijani Sufi community. But through each of these studies, you learn so much about affective belonging. You learn about the politics of belonging, about the ways in which these markers were signified for insiders and outsiders, and became central in identifying and shaping both personal practice as well as sort of a collective identity. And they're just incredibly rich ways of thinking about particular objects as being transformative and identifying.
The third part, objects and practice, looks at the life of material items in action. All the essays are great, but these are really, really interesting. What are the ways objects can shape behavior or conduct? And how do they help produce ethical habits or ideals?
Yeah, no, thanks. That so here in this set of essays, we have a piece by Mark Swallow on the lamp that is lit in Bektashi Sufi traditions in Turkey. An essay on ta'weez or amulets that are made by a Muslim woman healer in India by Joyce Flukiger. And an essay on the tablet on which people in this case in Morocco used to learn the Quran as a discipline. And this is by Omar Boum. And there, each of these essays, again, gives you not only a glimpse into that particular Islamic world, but also shows you how working and being with these objects shapes the individuals as the appropriate users of those very objects. So in the case that Omar writes about in his story about a former slave who grows up in a zawiya, in a Sufi center, and just happens to come to the attention of the Sufi teacher because he's been memorizing the Quran just by being in this atmosphere. And then he is given a tablet, he's given a pen, he's shown how to prepare and use the tablet and the pen and how to interact with it and to come to see this as an extension of his own body and also as a marker of his changed status as somebody who's now literate and somebody who is deeply respected as as somebody who is a knower of the Quran. And so I think all of those essays in various ways show us that. The Mark Swallow's essay on the Bektashi lamp, you see how the poetry that the Bektashis recite reflects ideas of light and illumination as being a really powerful sign and metaphor for insight and understanding for the practitioner in relation to the master and in relation to God. And so there's these very rich multi-layered readings. And Joyce Flukiger's essay on the ta'weez tells you so much about how the ability to make these particular objects and what they represent as both as a woman healer in a context where women are not always identified as being the carriers of these traditions. But, you know, this account tells you a lot about the making, the structure, the relationships, and really that incredibly relational quality of the Tawiz as being predicated on how the healer and her clientele are interacting around these objects and you know what's involved in that whole dynamic. So objects in practice.
The last part you call circulatory systems. It's kind of hard to characterize. I'm hoping you can do a better job than I can, but it's something we might think of it, how things in their own conceptual motion disrupt assumptions about materiality itself. I don't know if you would agree with that description, but what are your authors trying to do in this section? And what do you hope readers come away with when thinking about material Islam after reading these essays?
Yeah, well, I think you're totally right that in some ways these essays, particularly the last two, in that they're talking about water, which is both a thing and also not a thing in a sense. I mean, can one draw out a single drop of water, which is what Dee Fairchild Ruggles does in her chapter on the Aljube del Rey in Granada. And this idea that where she's imagining tracing the movement of a single drop of water through these aquifers and aqueducts and the systems that brought water from the mountains to these huge settlements in or from the time huge, and again, what is the minutia of that? How did that actually come into be? How did that move? Who is involved in making that? But then how also does the water itself shape that system and demand certain kinds of human responses? So here we see the sense that, you know, humans can try to modify the world around them, but there are also ways in which the world demands particular kinds of interactions. Even if you were going to try to modify it, you have to respond to the condition in which it is in. And similarly, in Anna Gade's piece on the Zemzem water and the aquifers and the system of water and what this means for the environment, she's making lots of claims and challenges about the ways in which environmental humanities can really bring new insights into material religion that are often not considered. So one of the things that this set of essays where we think of, and in Roxani Margariti's piece on numismatics, on coinage, then the Rasulid period that have fish on them and what that circulating object of the fish signified, both in terms of its relationship to political power, but also its relationship to currency and financial power, and also in its relationship to a particular notion of Islamicness that is being expressed through the movement of objects. So in all three of these essays, we see there's a specificity, but also an abstraction. You know, we have a couple examples of particular coins, but we, you know, following a coin would be a slightly different project. We have this whole hydrological system in Granada, but we're trying to trace a particular drop as a way of understanding all of the forces and all of the elements that make up a hydrological system, and that come to be found sort of reaching their apex for Ruggles in this well and how humans interacted with that. And then for Gade, who's really trying to disrupt our whole notion of human-oriented understandings of reality, she takes on a lot of religious studies theory. She digs back into Eliada and other sources in order to think about how we think about materiality and how we think about religion and categories and being and of in this world. So they're kind of the most atypical objects in the groups of all the objects in the book. But then I think through that, we also see the sort of expansiveness that is possible if we don't think of Islamic objects purely, again, in terms of the very traditional kinds of things that, you know, what is an Islamic object? We imagine perhaps prayer beads, but, you know, not in nearly as complex a way as Kobo illustrates. We might think about calligraphy. We might think about particular manuscripts and that have certain histories. But these things, I think, help us to expand our senses about what is a material object and what is material Islam.
Yeah. And I think at this point in the book, if you are reading through the whole book, it kind of lays out more dominant approaches to material Islam. And then this kind of helps kind of shake the ground a little bit more to say, well, what else can we do here?
Yeah. It's a provocation, if you will, that I think opens up some great doors, which is something that, that Gade is fantastic at.
So it's a wonderful book. I hope listeners will check it out. I'm excited to hear about these other projects that are going on in the future. I'm as somebody who's edited books, I know you can't include everything you want. So I want to ask you not only what are some of the things that you would have hoped to include in the book that perhaps you weren't because of whatever reasons, but also if we think of the book as a prompt, what might you suggest or gesture to as the future study of Islam through objects? What kind of things would you hope to see if you could, you know, shake a little wand and make all the projects come out as you want them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, there's so many things that one would want to do if you had all the time and space and resources in the world, and that everybody was always, if their schedules always worked on your timetable as well, which I know since you just had a big edited volume come out that, you know, that's not how that works always.
But, yeah.
We can dream. And so I mean, one thing that's also coming out of this broader project, I mentioned briefly in the beginning that Kambiz, Ghanaya Basri, and I are working on this edited issue, I guess. It's funny to call an online journal an issue, but I suppose it is. And so this, an issue of MAVCOR, the Yale Material and Visual Cultures of Religion Project. And so that's one next thing that we're doing to try to keep the conversation going with some of the people that we worked with and some new people that has a bunch of different essays. And these are kind of in a different format. So there's both long form journal articles, that are investigating the practice of Khalwa, for example, by Nate Hofer has got a fantastic essay on the sort of the material and embodied somatic experience of Sufi retreat. And another essay that is going to be by Kambiz himself on, which will be a short object narrative, which is a format they have on mosque socks and socks that you can wear all day to keep your ablutions active. So there's a whole range of things. And then I'm contributing an essay to that on some of the work that I've been doing in India, in particular in this essay on a shrine that a Sufi tomb shrine in Bengaluru, that is visited once a year by a Hindu priest who's incarnating a goddess. And she comes and dances around this tomb three times during a overnight procession around the city that happens in the spring every year. So I'm interested in some of those material exchanges that occur at this shrine, both in that sort of spectacular way, but also in an everyday sense, very much as thinking about these material engagements and bodily engagements as ways of expressing and marking collective belonging in this locale and of being a part of that place, which is partly animated by the recognition of religious others as being joint members of that community, and for those who are not following the current political conditions in India right now for Indian Muslims, that's been a particularly challenging enterprise to remind non-Muslim Indians that they are in fact members of the same society and culture and history and should be valued as such. So there's a whole bunch of other pieces that are coming out in that group that'll be exciting. But one thing I would actually kind of hope that might be taken up would be to see volumes like Judaism through objects and Baha'i through objects, et cetera, and sort of to see if there would be, you know, these shorter teachable essays that could help to expand through particular things our understandings of a host of religions. So rather than, again, beginning with, you know, a sort of linear chronological histories that parade from the beginning to now, thinking about disrupting that a little bit and recognizing that if we don't start with origins, then we actually can relocate power and authority within the religions as objects of study. And that could be a really productive and exciting direction for the study of religion more broadly.
Yeah, that sounds great. This has been wonderful. I want to give you an opportunity. I don't know if there's anything that we didn't discuss or any other projects you want to discuss that you're working on now before I let you go.
Well, I've got a couple of projects on. One is a project I've been doing for something like 10 years now, comparing shared spaces in India and Turkey and looking at how people imagine secular belonging in constitutionally secular but increasingly religiously nationalist polities such as India and Turkey. And I'm interested in those spaces where religions, minority and majority religions, are still gathering together and how that informs their conceptions of being part of the same society. And so that's a project I'm writing on, and hopefully we'll finish before the end of time. And I've also, right up your alley, Christian, started a kind of a digital humanities project with some colleagues in France and in the US who are all studying shared sacred spaces. And we're developing a mapping and visualization project where we could provide resources and materials and bibliographies and images and videos of spaces where multiple religions have been gathering historically or presently, and that have been very richly studied, but are often downplayed because as humans, we all seem to be crisis driven, and we look at things where everything is falling apart, but there's actually these very rich and robust histories of collective belonging in shared spaces. And so we want to make that sort of an evidentiary tool that people can use to push back against certain expectations, not rejecting the idea that conflict happens at all, but rather simply trying to bring this into the story as well, that these are going on at the same time and always have been. And so that's something that we're just getting off the ground, and hopefully we'll be landing on the web in the coming years.
Cool. That sounds awesome. Good luck finishing them before the end of time.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for making time to talk about this great project.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure. Thank you for having me.